Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, the Book of the Week format podcast that operates on the world's most liberal definition of the word book. This week, we are taking extra time to allow ourselves to read Charles Dickens's Bleak House by discussing an album of music. In this case, Q Roan, which is stylized as Q period, two spaces, Roan period. A collaborative work by Peter Blagvad, who wrote the lyrics, John Greaves, who wrote the music, and Lisa Herman, who sings the majority of the vocals. And this is an album that's I've begun listening to in the last year or so, and is very interesting to me, I think, as an experiment to expand the range of the ways in which words and texts can be used in the context of music, or to kind of move as far away as possible from the standard frameworks for how we generally, how lyrics in the context of music generally operate. Blagvad was briefly, a member of the notorious avant-garde rock band Henry Cow, where Greaves played bass. And in Henry Cow, Blagvad had quite a lot of difficulty learning and performing Cow's extremely complex compositions. Oh my god, extremely complex compositions, rather. And so Blagvad set out to make something which achieved a form of lyrical complexity similar to the instrumental complexity of Cow's music, and created an album which uses lyrics in ways that are, I think, rather unlike any other piece of music I'm aware of, with each song being essentially kind of a different sort of lyrical puzzle. And even a basic understanding of what's happening here lyrically requires reading along with the booklet, even though, you know, Herman's is a very clear singer. It's not a question of this being a death metal album where the lyrics are unintelligible for stylistic reasons. There are also several tracks that have lyrics that refer either to the painting on the cover or to cartoons within the booklet. So, you know, it's difficult to summarize what's happening here lyrically in a general way. And so I thought it might just be interesting to kind of, to start by asking a few kind of broader questions and then maybe zoom in and tackle our sense of what a few of these songs are kind of doing as individual pieces. So I guess the first question just to get a read, I guess, on what to expect for the tone of the conversation, what did each of you... I'm curious about it, to know for each of you, you know, what you generally thought of the album, if you were mystified by it or felt like you could generally get a pretty quick sense of what each song was trying to do. Chris, what was your response?
I listened to the album with the booklet first, and that first... play through, read through, I was mostly pretty frustrated. I felt like maybe I was experiencing the sort of I don't know, like, God, this is so navel-gazy, like, this is so self-indulgent, this doesn't mean anything. And the second time through, I began to appreciate just actually kind of trying to disentangle, like, what was being said and recognizing, you know, like, that the art and the... Well, like the different modalities, the lyrics and the art specifically, like the second time through, I was recognizing where the you know, the music and the art would sort of almost deviate from each other. I guess the music would, the lyrics would deviate from the art. Like the lyrics would start describing the what is in the visualizations, and then move into a kind of a higher plane or kind of like just stop directly describing and start really exploring and inventing. So there's a little bit of like stream of consciousness there. But that, in that second time through, I was I was thinking that this was interesting, but also still self-indulgent and still not worth my time, because I because I was like, well, all right, cool. You have like music, you have artwork, you have lyrics, and you know what's really like seems like is sort of necessary here is some kind of synergy, right? Like if there's not synergy, then you know, between these elements, then I kind of find this whole thing pretty masturbatory. And I was sort of prepared to have that attitude. And then today I was doing a decent amount of driving today. So I just listened to it and I completely flipped backward, and I actually think I kind of love it. I was just because like I wasn't trying to investigate it or anything like that. I was I'd sort of maybe internalized enough of like the pieces of it not to understand it. I'm not going to pretend to understand it, but that just to kind of experience it. And it kind of won me over today. So that's where I'm at. I don't know, you know, I could say that, each song, I think I could say that, you know, maybe we could dive into, but it feels like at least one of the subjects of the album that seems to recur is like what something is, like whether something is the name of the thing or the description of the thing or the picture of an incomplete image of a thing as you know, representative of the thing itself. It feels like that is a sort of recurring theme in the album. And that's what, that's about as far as I, you know, could get in sort of a thematic analysis. I think that, you know, with your guys' help, I could get to maybe a couple of other granular levels, but, it feels like it's really talking about, how we like recognize, name, identify, think about, separate, distinguish, things. So
names are not the pledge for things, but things for names. A Romanian proverb used in the lyric of the first song. Which, I mean, yeah, I like that as a statement of theme, right? And that's not really something I had laid out in the questions, because I don't know that I've listened to this album quite a bit. It actually, I don't just use Spotify for music listening. Like there's a few different, you know, I have an iPod, I listen to hard copies, whatever. But like, it's a decent portion of my music listening. And in my Wrapped, this is actually my third most listened album of 2025. So I've sat with it quite a lot. And I think like I went through the same arc that you did, right? Where like I kind of went at it just wanting to pay enough attention to it to crack it. But at some point really just kind of started appreciating it on a kind of in the sort of gut level aesthetic way that you would any other music that you like, you know. But Patrick, I judging by when you asked me about downloading the PDF of the booklet, it sounded like you didn't listen to this until yesterday. So you might have just been stuck at stage one of Chris's journey there. But maybe I'm making an assumption. I might be wrong. What was your experience and response?
I listened to it twice, and I intellectually I found it very interesting. I wouldn't say that I ever enjoyed it on a gut level, except for maybe like some of the cool textures that the album has, like some strange distorted sounds pop up on a couple different tracks. And then on the last track, Gegenstand.
Yeah, that was my first favorite too. That's I dig that, whatever that is.
No, there were some like cool like Some albums have used empty space real well. Like to my mind, The Eye of Every Storm by Neurosis is an album that uses empty space really, really well. And I won't say that like as a whole for this album, but I thought that song used empty space really well. And like I reacted to it on a way more personal level. While I was like parallel to listening to this album, I've also been listening to a lot of Dying Fetus, the technical death metal band, which, you know, I just kind of figured out were really good. And like a lot of the chaos of this album reminds me of the chaos of something like Dying Fetus. Like obviously, like Dying Fetus, the lyrics are not nearly as sophisticated, and like, you know, if I want to listen to death metal with lyrics that I find interesting, I would listen to Immolation. But you know, there's some fun in just letting go and letting these heavy albums talk about, you know, killing fetuses basically or whatever just for fun, you know. There's something primal in it in caveman like which seems okay to me. But structurally, like Dying Fetus sounds a lot like this to my mind, maybe more a lot like Qrhon. That I mean, Dying Fetus is more willing to like do like more willing to repeat a little bit. There are more like sections of like there are more headbangy sections where it's really rhythmic and chuggy, but there's a lot of that. There's still a lot of that like technical stuff and progression and movement, like changes that don't really make sense, that feel chaotic. Something that you would associate with like prog rock. And so I enjoyed it like on that intellectual level, comparing it to like music that I would choose to listen to on a regular basis, like Dying Fetus or Immolation or Obscura by Gorguts is like maybe the most apt comparison I can think of. And I also enjoyed it on the personal intellectual level because it made me feel like I understood your music more, Hans. Listening to your music, I like your music. Again, it's like a different, like it occupies a different headspace than where I usually go to. I like music that kind of sucks you down into a hole and hypnotizes you. Like that's kind of a big thing that I really like out of music, which prog rock doesn't really do that. It's prog rock is always way more like, to me, it seems like you have to be more versed in music theory and more versed in the vocabulary of music than I currently am to really understand how good prog rock music is. Like, I think if I, like, I don't really call myself a musician. I just sometimes make something that is loosely call music. right. You know,
it's like I'm not gay. I just fuck around with boys, you know.
Well, I mean, if you don't swallow, right? Like, if you don't swallow, or and you don't, you're not the bottom, right? You know, knowing where your music comes from, like understanding that there's a tradition to your music, like that made me appreciate your music more. So I'm not saying that I would, that I'm going to listen to this album a lot, but, you know, I think it was valuable. Absolutely.
Good, good. I think that this is a little bit of a discursion from, you know, the ostensible topic. I'm the master here, right? I could grab the reins and put us back on the topic. A thought about, you know, what you said about progressive rock generally. I I've been a really, really big fan of progressive rock since I was maybe in fifth grade, and I don't think that I had any meaningful amount of musical theory training or knowledge until somewhere in the realm of 10 years ago. So there's about 20 years where prog rock was kind of my favorite thing in the world, and I had very little sense of, in any kind of theoretical way or, analytical way, what it was doing that made it different from AC/DC, right? I think what attracted me to progressive rock generally as a child and kind of instilled an interest in it was more the sense of it as like a sort of a imaginary textural landscape, right? Like, you listen to Yes or King Crimson or Old Genesis or, you know, Van de Graaff Generator or whatever. And I think when I was younger, that just sort of felt like this interesting, imaginative space to kind of live in and exist in and to kind of color the world, you know? And maybe, I don't know if that's so different from what you describe, your sense of being kind of sucked in, right? Piece of music. It's actually, I think, maybe experientially a pretty similar thing. It's just that what's gotten you to that point is like a sense of kind of repetition and maybe even...
Absolutely.
You know, I think it's like there's something in our personalities that's triggered in an opposite way, right? For you, that's triggered by repetition. For me, that's triggered by surprise. And so I don't know that I have anything else to say in relationship to that, just that I don't want you or any listener to think that I'm going out there and saying that, like, appreciation of progressive rock requires dense theory knowledge, or that I, as a guy with a Genesis tattoo, have, like, uniquely intelligent understanding of what music does, because neither of those things is remotely true. And if anything, I've spent most of my life being very insecure about my lack of any kind of formal musical knowledge or training, you know?
Sure.
But I think that it is certainly true that, you know, once you acquire some level of music theory, it's very interesting to come back to something like King Crimson and go, oh, shit. But I think also, like, almost any music that you're passionate about, if you want to study it in the appropriate way, you can find layers of richness, right? I mean, you can go back to AC/DC if you've, you know, if you spend a few years playing drums or guitar, you can go back to AC/DC and find interesting layers there too, right? Or whatever, right? Neurosis or whatever kind of not conventionally progressive music. None of which necessarily relates directly to Q-Rone, right? I mean, I think that your point about some of the chaos of Q-Rone is well taken and is part of what I appreciate about it. You know, the sonic texture here is this kind of interesting hybrid of, like, progressive rock in the sense that it's usually understood, plus a certain amount of maybe, like, jazz and show tunes. I don't like show tunes at all, but I think it's still hard to not hear a little bit. I don't think this was influenced by show tunes, but I think in some places it kind of comes back to something that it finds its way kind of by accident to something that reminds me a bit of show tunes in the sense of being this kind of like wordy, bright, musical texture with a vocal technique that I think is actually pretty similar to a lot of theater musicals. The difference here being that, you know, like a show tune generally is trying to express, a show tune is advancing the narrative texture of a play by making a clear emotion present, right? And rather than doing that, you know, these tunes are saying, you know, cylinder of dust, salt cross with a crust of iodine, plank of pine, loaf of rust, right? So
yeah, the overall like general feeling I got was from like movies, from the soundtracks from movies from like the 70s, like, which this was made in what, 77? So that makes sense. And I recall, I went to my brother's senior musical, and he was in Jesus Christ Superstar. And I recall, the music of Jesus Christ Superstar having us at least a superficial similarity to the overall vibe of this album. So like saying show tunes makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, in general, I don't enjoy show tunes much. I think part of what I find interesting and compelling about this, I think, is like the fusion of that kind of texture with this lyrical approach that's totally unlike that. Right. And I think anytime, and you know, one thing that I don't know, like I think a lot about kind of the exhaustion of style, right, in music. The idea that there is perhaps like we've reached a point where it's very difficult to find a new stylistic perspective as a musician. And so whenever I encounter a piece of music, whether old or new, that fuses stylistic elements in ways that feel distinct to me, I still appreciate that. That's interesting. And so I think that the choice here to kind of fuse what's at least partially a show tune texture with these kind of like much more avant-garde lyrical texts, I can't think of a lot to compare that to. And so I find that interesting. Just to kind of talk through some of the individual songs, I kind of went back and forth about how to approach this album, right? On the one hand, thinking that it might be best to try to talk about it more broadly. On the other, thinking it would be fun to kind of go through individual tracks. But I don't know that, and I still don't know what the best way is, but just to kind of talk through some of the specific songs and what they're doing, why they're doing what they're doing, to the extent that that's discernible. The first song, 22 Proverbs. So it's, I mean, the name is quite apt there, right? It's 22 proverbs from various cultures and various times in history, some of which are more familiar than others, some of which are much more understandable than others, some of which are just total nonsense, I think. A notable one, there's one in here, one of the proverbs is, "What have I to do with Bradshaw's windmill?" I spent a certain amount of time trying to research what that means. It is from a real book of Proverbs, but the only analysis I could find was from other people being puzzled by this song, right? But some of the Proverbs, I think, are quite poetic and say things in interesting ways, right?
The very next proverb, number 17, after "What I have to do, what do have I to do with Bradshaw's windmill?" You know, I don't know how they stole this from Peter Steele on "World Coming Down." "Better to live one day as a lion than live 100 years as a sheep." How did they have a time machine and steal that? Is that what happened?
That's an interesting one, too, because, like, I don't know the era of Roman, Italian 50-liter coin that comes from, but
yeah, yeah,
it feels a bit fascistic, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Greaves and Blegvad would have been very, very, very aware of, because they were, they were in Henry Cow, who were, like, the most Marxist prog rock band in the world, right? So, like,
too bad they couldn't be a death metal band. The most Marxist death metal band.
There's probably actually several metal bands that call themselves the most Marxist metal band.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
Pretty common.
But some of the other ones, "One should write bad things on running water," a Romanian proverb. "A drowning man would catch at razors," an Italian proverb. I just really like those. They're interesting ways to express ideas, and you kind of have to squint at them for a bit, but then they kind of resolve, you know.
Is that let me ask this. So you just pointed out the number 17 is fascistic, and the first proverb of this 22 proverbs is a version of something that quote unquote philosopher Ayn Rand would say frequently, have your cake and eat it too. Is there a connection there? Like, are they being pointedly anti-fascist, or you think I'm just seeing things?
They might be. I mean, it's certainly the people who made this definitely had a strong political conscience. Maybe not so much these two individuals, but they were involved in Greaves and Blegvad, but they were involved in Henry Cow, who were an incredibly political band. So it's hard to see. I don't think that I would have thought of it myself that way, but I don't think that that's, I think that might very well be true, right? I think when I've thought about, well, I don't know. I have my thoughts about what this piece is doing, but before I, just to avoid kind of dominating the whole podcast, which I certainly could easily, like, Chris, Patrick, did you guys have any thoughts about, like, I mean, Patrick, sounds like you were thinking about kind of the political valence of this, which might be very wise. Did you have other thoughts about how these all sort of fit together, or what purpose this assemblage might be serving?
I don't know. Because it doesn't seem to me like there's a sort of like a consistent topic here. And maybe that is itself like something. I mean, we think of like proverbs, and they're basically like memes. They're like ancient memes that have been used to the extent that they've become sort of like fixed, very in some ways dead, you know, right? That's when something becomes really cliche, but still routing a lot of bandwidth, you know, for human communication. And so in a way they kind of represent like, almost like communication infrastructure. Like they're something that, you know, has survived. You know, if you think about all the fucking shit that has been said, that's, you know, like disappeared in time, but for whatever reason, these things last. I think, you know, that's where my head goes. And it does seem like communication is, like I said before, like something that this album is inherently like interested in. So that's my feeling on it, but I don't really know beyond that kind of like that just conjecture.
I mean, I like that way of thinking about it, right? That these are partly ways of studying how information endures, right? How language, they're ways of studying how language preserves and encodes and preserves ideas and information, right? Because many of these are, in their way, very mysterious. I think they almost all make sense to me now that I've lived with them for a bit, right? Other than, again, the one about Bradshaw's windmill. But it's like they're the act of pondering each of these and kind of trying to decode the wisdom from it. On the one hand, yeah, I think is a way of kind of pondering more generally how language serves as a vessel, right? And I think also kind of makes the song a little bit of a microcosm of the album in a way, right? Where, you know, each of the songs on this album is using language in a different way to try to convey ideas or meaning or texture. And it's like each of the songs is kind of a version of the experience of pondering each of these individual proverbs. So it's both, I think, a meditation on one of the themes of the album, and also kind of a way of introducing the process of listening to the album. So the next song on it is called, well, technically the third song, because there's sort of like a brief intro that is just instrumental. But the third song is called Seven Scenes from the Painting, Exhuming the First American Mastodon by C.W. Peale. And essentially this is a kind of a set of comments upon the cover painting. There's technically a term for this. I can't remember what it is. I don't know if either of you recall it, where you're ekphrastic. Yes, it's a particularly dense and odd ekphrastic song. So, Chris, I was thinking about this a little bit when you were talking about your experience listening to this album, right? Because the you mentioned kind of thinking about some of the ways in which the lyrics will sort of like start with the image and then move beyond it, right? In sometimes odd ways. So was this the song that you were thinking of when you were talking about that process?
I think I first really noticed it. I didn't notice it with this song the first time, really. I think it was just too much. I noticed it more with the, which one is it? It's the fifth piece, Pipeline, with the figures.
Yes.
Cause that's simpler.
Yeah.
And then the second time through was when I guess the second time through I was actually like looking for it more. And yeah, the painting, has on the cover of the album certain sections basically outlined with numbers corresponding to the sections of the song that speak to them. So it's a bit like a bit like figure one, figure two, figure three in a sort of textbook. And you know, we get to figure four, three green umbrellas are shown in all. These denote degrees by which a fall from grace may be measured as virtual, potential, or as actual. The first has been dropped, the second picked up but not untied. The third has been spread high over the head to hide the sky. And obviously that, you know, I don't even think you necessarily need to look at the painting to recognize how, you know, that is, you know, playing with, you know, interpreting the what's actually going on and then using that interpretation as a launching point for to kind of explore new spaces that otherwise wouldn't exist. And I think that that's where one of your questions was like, what is this album without the booklet? And, you know, if the album, if the lyrics were just describing, if it was ekphrastic in such a way, it was just basically describing what was in the accompanying artwork, then it's a bit like a map at the beginning of a fantasy novel or whatever, right? It's like Tolkien, you know, the map is interesting, but it's not necessary as an element for teasing out where the text and the map disagree. Or not disagree, but basically where the lyrics stop following the map. And so actually, weirdly, it's kind of a paradox in my head. The artwork becomes more necessary as an accompanying text as the lyrics deviate from it, because then it becomes something that you reference to recognize when that deviation occurs. And it becomes a reference point that the lyric that is offset from what the lyrics are saying in a way that I think creates new space. Like it's like connecting the dots, and if the dots overlay each other perfectly, then, you know, there's not really a purpose. But once they begin to deviate, like in space, in you know, and they create a plane between them, and that seems to be where the artwork becomes really interesting, actually. And I have the painting open right now on Wikimedia, just sort of way blown up, and I'm looking at those umbrellas. And yeah, it's just, it's interesting. It makes the artwork more, I think, and together, I think they're they're greater than the sum of their parts because of what Blegvad is doing with those lyrics. I don't know about the music, though. That's an aspect of the synergy of the trio, right? Of like lyrics, artwork. So the lyrics purely as like text, you know, as like thinking about the meanings of the words, the visual accompaniment, those two, I think, have a clear synergistic relationship, but I'm not sure about the music. Like, I like the music, but I don't know that it is like compounding the complexity of the other two in quite the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me at least, it might be that there's some space in which the music can compound the complexity of the other two. For me, I found it more significant just as a way of making the other two appealing, right? It adds a layer of, strange to say, beauty, because this is mostly pretty arcane music, but like, having listened to the album, you know, a decent amount over the last year, I can pretty much, like, in most cases, look through the booklet and kind of hear the texts in the melody that they're presented, right? And we'll sometimes, like, get little bits of this just sort of running through my head like jingles, which is is an odd experience for something that's this arcane, right? But it's like the music seems less maybe like a vector for meaning and more so as kind of a means of like a sweetening mechanism to make the whole package more appealing. And it might be that there are things I'm missing and that a skilled interpreter could find those out, right? As far as your thought about, I really like your thought about what the lyrics are doing in relationship to the painting, right? All three of us have taught undergrad literary interpretations, right? Or we've taught undergrad classes on literary interpretation. We've taught, you know, in our particular system, Writing 211 or English 211, right? Which is Introduction to Writing About Literature. And one of the things that you always have to kind of try to wring out of people, iron out of people, is the idea of the sacrosanctness of author intention, right? Or that the text can only contain so much because there are only a certain finite number of accurate meanings in it, right? And if that were true, then the whole academic practice of lit crit would be in some ways irrelevant, right? Or it would be much more focused on new texts that had more juice left in them to squeeze. But I think the line about the umbrellas in particular here is an interesting one, because obviously C.W. McCall was not, in fact, trying to, it's I think reasonably safe to assume that he was not using the three green umbrellas to denote degrees by which a fall can be measured as virtual potential or as actual. And I think there's a shift that happens in that song where you really kind of start to realize how, exactly as you said, Chris, how that gap is created and how I like this idea, it's very perceptive, right? That like the presence of the painting is meaningful not as a way of confirming the rightness of that, but by clarifying how much it's adding degrees of meaning that are not automatically contained in the original image. I think that there's a fun little trick there. You might have noticed this, Chris, but the first line is, "Youth with no name cuts out of the frame with an axe." The painting does, in fact, contain a boy with an axe, or a young man with an axe, who is chopping in the direction of the edge of the right edge of the frame. But the version that appears on the cover, there's an image of a frame added with a little notch taken out of it, as though the youth is literally chopping the frame of the painting. And that's not in any of the versions I'm seeing online. I believe that detail was actually added by, presumably, Blegved. I'm not sure what purpose it serves beyond kind of, again, playfully asserting that... playfully asserting the sort of the unreliability of this. So, just kind of thinking about how this feeds into like the larger ideas of the album, I think that the, you know, you had talked, Chris, about the first song as the thinking about these proverbs as vectors of meaning. I'm using the word vector a lot today. That's very annoying. But thinking about using the proverbs as ways of thinking about how language encodes ideas, right? And this becomes then a way of thinking about how images do or do not encode meaning. And so, you know, in that way, it becomes a partly, I think, a kind of a meditation on the relationship between language and meaning, but I think also the nature of art, right? Because I didn't really mention this when you were talking about it earlier, but the song about the proverbs in particular, or the list of proverbs, I think partly is it's not just about the transmission of meaning. To me, at least, there's a kind of a joy taken in that too, right? Like, a pleasure and a glee in the different strange ways that these phrases convey ideas. And so I think that sense of play is very important too, right? Like, there's an idea that I think comes up a certain amount on this podcast, that all art, all successful art, is in some way about itself, right? In ways that can sometimes, for instance, be optimistic, right? Like a very successful song about suicide is implicitly a rejection of the idea of suicide, even if the song itself skillfully advocates for suicide, right? Because the act of the creation of something beautiful and effective is inherently humanistic in ways that I think through their very success can kind of undermine pessimism. And this is a very interesting album in that way, because in some ways I think, like, on a surface level, a lot of the material kind of makes a case maybe against the reliability or the usefulness of language or art as a medium, because there is so much weirdness and absurdity and unreliability here. And yet also, I think to me at least as a listener, right, by like being as effective as it is with thought at getting ideas through and just kind of creating aesthetic joy, it becomes also active advocacy for those things. All that being said, Q Roan, the title cut, right? First half is a set of anagrams. Everything in it is made from the letters in the city titles Q and Roan. Second half is one kind of builds into a big palindrome. Peels foe, not a set animal, laminates a tone of sleep. I will admit, after all the things that I just said, that I've never really been able to get much out of the fourth track other than just the simple fact of its existence, right? The kind of challenge of making something that is anagrams and palindromes. Did either of you have any thoughts about that track?
Nothing constructive.
I had a thought, and it kind of goes back to why are you using the word vectors so much?
Maybe because a lot of the way that we've been considering the album is as a means of transmission, and vector seems like a handy way to tap into the idea of a thing that carries or transmits in a somewhat intellectual sounding way, but that doesn't have too many syllables.
Well, And I apologize. There should be, what do you call it when everything gets compared to, everyone gets compared to Nazis? What's that called?
Somebody's Law.
Somebody's Law. There should be something for AI, like how often AI comes up. Maybe it's just because I continue to be fascinated and horrified and everything by it. But I'll get back to vectors in a second, but it has to do with this. When the title track, Curon, it feels like kind of nonsense words that are just basically recycling all of the letters in the words Curon. And then it is, it seems to be almost like figuring out how to say something about the painting. With those phonemes, those available phonemes. And I just happened to be listening to a Radiolab yesterday, the most recent one. And it is about AI. And one of the segments in that larger podcast is a sort of old recording of a very proto AI learning how to say a sentence. And the difference between, and basically the whole subject of the episode is how, you know, why is it that these AI that we're using all over the place now are actually kind of a black box. We don't really know what makes them function the way that they function because they teach themselves. And that's distinguishing from, you know, like programming every little thing into it, you know, so like you have a 100 by 100 lattice of variables, and you can, you know, change each variable to program it to do certain things. And it is less efficient in the end to program it to say certain words, because there are so many different words, than it is to program it to learn how to say words. But when you program it to learn how to say words, that mesh becomes meaningless to you. It develops internal meaning. It becomes a bunch of numbers and random things and random connections that have been strengthened and weakened in different places to basically make that algorithm react in a way that you want it to. And setting aside whether that is intelligence or not, what it is using is something called a vector database. And this is where vectors come in. So like all those numbers are sort of like vectors through really like many, 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 you know, dimensions of just sort of like theoretical space. So like meaning becomes this thing that explodes in like a bunch of different non-physical directions, and then those numbers are sort of like directions through that space. And all this to say that listening to, I didn't think of this the first couple times through it, but listening to the title track today, it was really uncanny how much it sounded like that recording of a proto AI learning how to speak. It was like, basically, like, you know, you're given these rules and this task. Start with kind of chaos and just sort of mashing things together, and then you get to something that has meaning. And I don't, you know, this album that, you know, isn't probably has no concept of artificial intelligence in it, but there is an aspect of kind of like, I don't know, there's something about this album that feels programmy, that feels like it's anticipating cybernetics and you know, the Data era, and maybe it's just the Q.Rhone title that has me thinking that, or the way that it is, it seems to be storing information in a way that is like relational, not like not like how we think of information. But no, that's what popped into my head with Q.Rhone was how it seems to like it seems to kind of build toward something. Yeah.
Interesting. I like that idea. I don't know if I can carry it any further, but it's
yeah. So it's not, yeah, I realized partway through, like, I think that was maybe a very glancing impression because of, as I said, like, it was just happening. I happened to be like thinking about and listening to these related things at around the same time. So
Pipeline. This is the one with the cartoons. So basically, there's the idea is that there are one cartoon illustrates a trio of people standing around a length of dug up pipeline. So a part of the ground has been dug up and exposed what appears to be a portion of a length of pipeline. And then each of them has radically different observations about it. One asserts that ambiguity can't be measured like a change of temperature. What does that mean? Does that mean?
A change of temperature has specific, there's, temperature can be a specific degree, right? Like there are you know, linear measurements of temperature, you know, if we're in the Kelvin scale from zero to like whatever it is. Whereas ambiguity is much harder. It would be much harder to say how ambiguous an ambiguous thing is. Whereas degrees of temperature tell you exactly where you are on a scale, right?
Right. Is there, well, maybe we can come back to, I mean, I think that's, I like that parsing of that.
I mean, is that what you're getting at, or?
Oh, I don't think I was getting at anything other than just wanting to parse that phrase, right?
Oh, like, right, 'cause sure.
The track pipeline, right? Like, I enjoy pondering each of the individual layers or each of the kind of riffs on the cartoons, but I'm not sure, as often in this album, I'm not 100% sure what it all adds up to. And I was just kind of trying to make sure that I felt like I had my head wrapped around each of the pieces before we kind of ponder how they might add up to a whole. The third image, list of assorted equipage. A gentleman imagines how the items on the list would look if only partly exhumed. There's an axe, a bone, an umbrella, and a ladder. Each of those things, if the whole thing were buried, but just a portion of it were dug up, the handle of the axe, the shaft of the bone, a rung of the ladder, handle of the umbrella, all those things would look like a portion of pipeline that had been dug up. I don't know if there's anything really to say about that. I mean, it's an interesting illustration. But then the lady asserts, when you remove a rung from a ladder, the whole is suddenly part. The part is whole. But the hue and temperature of a pipeline are ineluctably parts. Without the pipeline, they would cease to be. What does that mean?
Nothing. No, I mean,
I've scratched my head over this one a lot.
I'm making jokes because I really like the lyrics to this whole album were pretty opaque to me, and I've been enjoying what you guys have said about it. But it's harder for me to like really generate or come up with deep interest in something that I probably think is like art commenting on itself, which is not something that really strikes or really resonates with me that much. So
I think that is, you know, one of the first strongest impressions that I had of this. And I don't know that my appreciation of the album entirely like dismisses that impression, which is that like, is like, this sounds very cold, but like, is this shit useful? You know, like it feels like, it is, I mean, like, you know, not everything should be useful, but I, you know, like that's, and I believe that to my core. But it's like, is this, Patrick's point about art commenting on itself is, I think, a pretty important one, which is like, is this, there's this whole space that's created in a kind of like a bubble universe where like complete nerds like us play. Like I was at a cafe earlier today and someone was talking about like really, really specific lore from Tolkien to three of his friends who were obviously very fucking bored. Like they were just like, oh my God, like, and he was right. Like, he was like, Tolkien describes Theoden as riding out ahead, even as the other writers, you know, ride faster. And he compares him to, I don't remember, some god from the Tolkien. And I don't want to shit on that. I really like that's, but like, is this,
I mean, you're allowed to be interested in Tolkien. Right.
You're allowed, you know, people, yeah, like, yeah. Not everything needs to be useful, but like,
right.
But the is, and sorry, Hans, this is, I'm realizing this is completely, this completely fucks everything probably, but it's like, you know, Patrick's point is, I think, kind of an important one, which is like, you know, is this sort of like us talking about the mythology of Middle Earth? It's just like, is this like that?
Well, no, because the mythology of Middle Earth can't, you can extract things from that to talk about the real world.
No, you can do that with this too, Patrick. You can do that with this too. Don't be a dick.
Okay, give me an example. Like I haven't, what example have you guys said yet? And I'm not trying to be a dick here.
I guess,
I'm like really.
How do you extract things from arcane details of Tolkien lore? I mean, I get I get the idea that like, oh, Sauron is the Nazis or whatever, right? Like, I get the idea that you can read Tolkien as an allegory for.
No. Sauron's not the Nazis. The correct what I think of as the correct interpretation of Middle Earth is that Tolkien was in some sense a Luddite. He was very wary and doubtful of industrialization and the advancement of technology. Hence, you've got you know, things like Saruman the Wizard has a mind of metal and wheels now. And ultimately, he thinks that technology will defeat an agricultural lifestyle, and he thinks that's true, but a thing to be mourned. So that's what I mean. I'm not like, you don't have to like Tolkien But obviously, I know you guys aren't big into Tolkien, and I'm not really big. I just, you know, have read the books and liked the movies and whatnot.
Nerd.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a nerd. Absolutely. So that's something like that's an example of something that like the work of art is commenting about reality in some way. Whereas what I was saying earlier is the main focus of this album, lyrically at least, seems to be about art commenting on itself or language commenting on itself. Like figure C in Pipeline is like I think actually now that I've come to this thought, maybe figure C is a good example of a way that this album is commenting on reality, in that like if you make these excavations in figure C, you reveal the shaft of an axe, the like a length of bone, a rung of a ladder, and the handle of an umbrella. You're not certain what they are until you excavate everything. And until you excavate everything, they could be the same thing, or they could each be a pipeline, right? So maybe that's a comment on like how human beings are prone to pattern making and are typically woefully ignorant until the whole thing is revealed. So maybe this is a good example of a way it is commenting on life.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that like the going back to vectors, right? So like that line, the hue and temperature of a pipeline are ineluctably parts. Without the pipeline, they would cease to be. And that contrasted with when you remove a rung from a ladder, the whole is suddenly part. I don't know if I totally understand that line, the rung from a ladder, the whole is suddenly part. The part is whole, but the hue and the temperature of a pipeline are ineluctably parts. The hue and the temperature of a pipeline are ineluctably parts. Without the pipeline, they would cease to be. Makes me think of how there's this weird intersection of taxonomy, like how we characterize and categorize things, observation, and physical, like empirical reality, where we, you know, the hue and temperature of a pipeline are actually, you know, they're really the same thing. Like when you heat metal, it gets reaches a certain temperature, it'll change color. And it's sort of like pressure and temperature. We think of them as different things, but you know, excited particles in an enclosed space, you know, that's an expansion of those particles. To fill that space is temperature. You know, if you actually compress things, they get really fucking hot. So like, you know, there's a weird thing there that is like, I think the razor's edge of like, you know, of useful meaning when it comes to this and Tolkien, when it, you know, it's like, it can veer very quickly into kind of, I don't know, just very playful, but not substantive like thought, which again, I don't want to shit on. Like it really does sound like I'm shitting on that, but I think that it is inherently interesting, and it does. I think it is. You know, I fucking love this shit. So I don't know why I'm crapping on shit that I love, but I'm just in that mood today, I guess.
A couple of things. First, the line about the ladder: when you remove a rung from a ladder, the whole is suddenly part. The part is whole. The whole is part because you have something that is only part of a ladder, right? The function of a ladder is to be climbed. If you remove a rung from a ladder, it is either diminished or useless as an apparatus of climbing. To say the whole is part, you have only part of a ladder. The part is whole. The rung you have removed becomes a stick. It's a thing that does, in fact, have at least, you know, possible function and utility by itself and can be kind of seen as a... Right. So it's kind of... There's an idea there about ontology, right? That some things... if you have something that is whole, if you remove a piece from it, part of it is diminished, part of it is, in a way, kind of reborn. I do think that, like, I mean, to your... I don't know. The question of, like, what use is this? I don't know. What use is an AC/DC song, right? Or I mean, to the point about Tolkien...
It's you bricked up.
Yeah, man. You got to listen to something while you're cleaning the fucking kitchen.
Oh. I thought we were talking about jacking off. Kitchen.
I mean... I do think that, like, there's a kind of a maybe a boundary here that if you want to be, if you want to primarily perceive art as a means of conveying, if your main way of thinking about it is as a utilitarian means of explaining ideas about how to perceive the world, there's an interesting boundary here, right? Where, like, figure C, I think, does actually could be very easily turned into a comment on the limits of human perception and the dangers of projection based on limited information, right? That bit, I think, you could, if you want to get morals out of things, you can get a moral out of that, right? The line about removing a rung from the ladder, comparing that to the hue and temperature of a pipeline, that is, I think, probably, even though, like, I know what it means, it feels less like something that I could show a child as a way of helping them understand the world, right? But we kind of had to parse these things to make that differential, you know? And I think there's, with the example of Tolkien, like, I read Lord of the Rings once, I saw the movies once, I don't like them, I'm not interested in the mythology, but I can understand your point about mechanization, right?
Right, right.
Like,
right.
I get it, totally. And so, I mean, I think that, like, again, Chris, the level of arcane lore, the level of arcane focus on lore you were observing, I think is probably not necessary to get the, what you might see as, like, the socially utilitarian idea out of Tolkien, right? But right, again, right, you right. kind of have to overshoot that mark to understand what it is in a way, right? So... I think this is somewhat accidental, but you can actually, like, the boundary here between the lesson about partially exposed axes and the lesson about ladders with rungs removed, one of those is, I think, helpful and utilitarian, one of those is arcane and useless, but you have to focus and think to find that boundary, and in a way, I suppose, that becomes another... The song then contains another lesson about the ways that language conveys meaning, right? But I'm very puzzled by the idea that thinking about how language conveys meaning is somehow useless. Like, that's incredibly, incredibly important. And, you know, like, Patrick, your idea that, you know, some of these proverbs encode a fascist meaning, that seems to me like a notable
I don't know that they do. I was just wondering if they do.
Well, they could, right? But I mean, I think the idea is that the idea is that they can, right? That you have these incredibly simple, straightforward things. Well, these very, I guess, like these things which use an almost elemental amount of information, right? 6-7 words. That's it, right? But that they actually have these kind of rich, each of them sort of contains this potentially very rich set of ideas all the way down to something that, you know, might be part of an idea structure that almost destroyed the world. That seems incredibly valuable to me as a thing to think about and ponder and acknowledge. And it might be that it's less straightforward and takes a greater amount of churning to get there than, you know, Tolkien equals fear of mechanization, right? But like, I don't, the idea that it's masturbatory or irrelevant, it just seems very sad to me. And I would, I think, pretty heartily disagree with. Like, difficult is not the same as useless. And considering the nature of language, considering the nature of, I mean, you can't think about, like, thinking about the nature of language and thinking about the functions of art, those are very, very closely related things and hard to extricate. And I don't think that pondering them is useless. I think it's incredibly useful.
Yeah, Chris. Jesus.
I'm glad. You know what?
Piece of shit.
I feel good about.
That's probably the most upset I've ever sounded while saying an incredibly dense, arcane thing that is.
I agree. Chris, I'm proud of. I'm proud of the little shit fit that I caused right there.
Yeah, that you did.
I feel. Whatever, this podcast was worth it for that.
I feel bad since, like, I wasn't really getting all that, but I did kind of start the whole thing by suggesting that this is self-referential stuff. And Hans, you at the very least have convinced me that. Well, one, I think that it's probably not as self-referential as I think, like art commenting on art, and it is, and like you say, you know, you're absolutely right. Like, thinking about ways in which language makes meaning, and thinking about, like, and like exercising the critical thinking of parsing sentences and thinking about how they mean what they mean is useful, interesting, and wonderful, and absolutely agree. So,
I mean, I do think that if it's all you do, it can become tiresome or irrelevant, right? In the same way that, like, if all you do is fulminate in the most literal manner possible, you know, like we're reading Bleak House in a couple weeks, right? And some of Bleak House is just literal fulmination, right? Dickens will describe a slum and say, this terrible slum is unfit for human habitation and we should be ashamed that we let this exist in London. It is artless, it is layerless, it is completely straightforward and didactic. And there's a value in that, right? But if all you have in your art is that, or all you have in your communication is that, right? It becomes tiresome and irrelevant. And I think, like, I don't think that there's only room in the world for Q Ronish sort of things. And I do think, you know, the three of us, like, coming from academia, probably have spent more time than many people immersed in this sort of thing and have the right to become tired of it if you don't also get to have a certain amount of, you know, shake your fist and yell in a direct, overt way, you know?
No, I'll say, like, I was kind of being contrary on a little bit on, I don't know, for funsies. I am big. I mean, we talked about it in the last episode where the sensation of being lost is very close to the sensation of being present for me. Or like it's one of the cleanest avenues for me to falling, like, into a space where I am, like, in the moment. And that's where I really found myself listening to this album today, like, on a drive. And I was, you know, just really appreciative of that. And I think teasing out the really complex things that, you know, this text is getting at through the intersection, the sort of incompletely outlined intersection of the different, you know, of the imagery and the lyrics and the music and the lyrics, you know, with the lyrics, you know, I think that's a really, I love that. I really dig that. I also think that, like, you know, you play this album for, you know, most people, and they're going to recoil from it. And then if you just sort of, if you is like, you know what, you should look at the booklet too. That's actually going to make it worse. You know, like, and I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, like right now, like we're kind of beyond where like the humanities were under attack for basically creating a sort of like, echo chamber where like we were sort of, investigating our own assholes, you know, and the sort of like war on the humanities has progressed beyond that point. And I think it's kind of important to acknowledge when something feels so, self-referential. And that's why when Patrick brought it up, it's like, yeah, this is the kind of thing that like people point to and they're like, Jesus Christ, like what the fuck are like,
yeah, I mean, that's definitely doing? True.
And
that is true. Yeah.
And I, you know, all that to say, like, I love thinking about this stuff. I love talking about this stuff. I love listening to this stuff. So, I think I say not everything has to be useful. I think it is useful. I think that it's not useful in, I don't know how to complete that thought, but it is worth my time, you know? And so I didn't mean to come across like it wasn't. I really enjoy this album. So,
I do recognize that like there's a very limited number of people who are going to be interested and are able to connect to this, right? And if there's like if you're thinking of the work in terms of conveying important ideas to people who need to hear them, I don't think it's particularly successful, right? On some level, I do personally, I don't know, like I just get depressed by the lack of ambition of almost all, I mean, I guess art, but I think about it in relationship to music in particular, right? Like so much, I don't know, like there's just so much music that is not trying to, like, this is obviously erring on the side of complexity and sophistication, but there's so much music that errs on the side of a complete and total lack of any attempt at complexity and sophistication. And, you know, that's, I think, maybe useless in its way, too. The song, just to kind of, I don't know if we're near an end here, but the song Nine Mineral Emblems, I think, is an interesting maybe outlier here because it is trying to, at least a little bit, and maybe you can correct me if you feel like I'm overstating it, but there's a sense of like trying to use these tools to express an emotional experience, right? In a way that is still kind of maybe overcomplicated or navel-gazing, but like it's in a way, it's a conventional love song, right? I am in love with someone who is not really as in love with me and keeps me at arm's length. But rather than say that, you know, in the plain way that many, 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 many songs have, it kind of uses nine minerals as metaphors for that. I don't know if I have any real point to say about that, but it seemed remiss not to mention it because it's structurally somewhat different from what other songs here are doing. Did you guys have any thoughts about reactions to that song?
Not really. I think you mentioned, I think, in your questions that you sort of fell off. And in the last couple songs, and yeah, I reached a kind of threshold for grokking.
I mean, to be clear, like I like Nine Mineral Emblems. If anything, I think it's kind of cute and relatively straightforward in a way that many of the others are not.
Yeah, I think like sure.
Sure, I don't have anything else to say.
Yeah, yeah. Just seemed worth acknowledging as kind of like a slight deviation from how a lot
of... So for the people who would be like really pissed off, like being forced to listen to this, just listen to Nine Mineral...
Nine Mineral Emblems. Thing.
Emblems, yeah. And that's... and if that's like not good for you, then you just, you know, just shunt it to one side. But I say that like you really have to kind of have like a stick-to-itiveness to enjoy stuff like you mentioned like Obscura, Patrick, and that's
Gorguts Obscura.
Yeah, I mean like you have to be like to enjoy stuff like this, like Sun City Girls, you know, Dante's Disneyland Inferno, like there's another one that it's not popping up. Some of the Swan's work, you know, that Gira did. Like, you know, you just have to kind of like keep going back to it, and like not just sort of bounce off of like how unpleasant it can feel. And this actually doesn't. This is not like Obscura for me. I actually like the music. And I like the Obscura music too. But I didn't the first 2 years that I tried to listen to that album. So like, this isn't like that, but
yeah, that seems like as good a stopping point as any, I guess. Sorry if I kind of derailed the conversation there by getting overly emotional. If it's any consolation, when we do Bleak House in 2 weeks, I'm really not enjoying Bleak House very much. So you guys can slag it.
All right. No, that's hilarious. I enjoyed this. Sorry, I have to run, guys. Yeah. I need to go rescue my wife from my son.
All right, one question before you go. Is your familiarity with the novel Dune about equivalent to your familiarity with Tolkien?
Yeah.
Both of you?
Oh, no, I know Dune way better.
You know Dune fairly well, but for you, Hans, it's about the same.
I read it 15 years ago, but I know the general outline of the plot and themes and watched the first
movie. All right. Okay. All right. Well, I'll see everybody later. Peace out.
See you later.
Have a good one. Good discussion, as usual.
Love talking to you guys. Bye.